Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. On today's show, I am pleased to be joined by Mike Todd, a seasoned expert in international business development with a rich history of helping consumer brands expand into the APAC markets. Mike shares invaluable insights from his experiences with major brands like Hunter, Swims, Uggs, and Mizuno, and discusses the strategies that led to their success in these competitive regions. Starting with an exploration of a strategic approach for each brand, Mike delves into the unique market dynamics and consumer behaviors in the APAC region that influenced his tactics. He also talks about the inception and growth of his own proprietary brand, providing a firsthand look at the challenges and rewards of building a brand from the ground up. As a senior advisor at Deeren & Associates, Mike outlines his role in assisting companies to navigate the complexities of international expansion. He highlights common pitfalls to avoid and offers tailored advice for Australian brands considering entering or expanding within the Chinese market or other international arenas. The conversation wraps up with Mike's forecast for the future, pinpointing sectors and markets that present lucrative opportunities for Australian brands aiming to go global. His advice is a must-listen for anyone looking to understand the intricacies of international brand expansion. Enjoy.
I have some go-to things that I do for brands when I meet them for the first time, and especially Australian brands, is the first thing I ask them for is their pricer. Can I see where your prices are? What are you selling at? Where's your margins? Because invariably, Aussie brands, and I can say that, they don't think international first, so they think domestic. So their margins tend to be for a domestic audience. And when they do come to us or they go on their own and they venture international, they realize that they've not actually planned any margins for international audience. So there's no distributor margin there.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation. Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Mike, welcome to The Negotiation.
Good morning, here from lovely sunny, little bit of sun coming in Sydney.
Nice. So you're in Sydney, Australia. Tell us a little bit about how you became involved and experienced and probably in love with that whole Southeast Asia region in which you do a lot of business now.
It's quite an interesting story. My father's worked in what you would classically call the oil industry. He was offshore on rigs when we were growing up. So he told us once in the back of a VW Beetle that he was going away for 2 weeks and he would have 2 weeks off at the end of it. So it was a 2 week on, 2 week off rota. And he ended up on what was at the time Occidental's Piper Alpha platform in the North Sea, which very sadly blew up in the 80s, but he wasn't on it. It was a huge incident during the 80s culturally at that time. But then he went to work around the world. Ended up in Singapore. We used to visit him in Singapore, and me and my brother were going there when we were 14. And I sort of fell in love with that sort of whole Asia thing, able to walk around on Orchard Road, buy strange things from Lucky Plaza, take tapes back and on-sell them at school. The food, oyster omelets, tiger beer, trying to sneak a tiger beer when I was 14 and big enough to get served and swatted over the back of the head by my dad when he realized I had left the hotel sort of area of the hotel. But that sort of 14-year-old getting a taste of Asia was just at that time mind-blowing. And I used to coming back and telling people back in my village in the north of England, it didn't quite compute. to me, I found it the best thing in the world. To them, they couldn't really quite understand half of what I was talking about.
More often than not, it's an accidental happenstance. You end up there, and then you just fall in love, and it's just so different and so unique and so much fun. I remember my experience. I don't think I've ever said this in the 5 years of the show. I've ever told anybody my first experience, but when I was in grade 7, there was a group that came to the school and they said, we're putting together a trip to go visit Japan and China and Hong Kong, and we're going to fundraise for probably 3.5 years. And by that time, you'll be in this grade at this high school and whatnot. And I signed up for it. And I spent 3.5 years. I was selling poinsettias at Christmas, and I was doing Super Bowl box pools, and I was selling chocolate covered almonds, and you name it. I was doing everything for, raised all the money, and we went on the trip. And that was my first experience. And it was very similar. It was down some back alleys. We would buy firecrackers and then go sit on the side of the lake in the, Shanghai Park and light them and throw them and light them and throw them. And then the police would come over and we were freaked out. We thought, oh, we're going to be in so much trouble. We're going to Chinese jail. They just stood there and they laughed and they enjoyed it. And they're like, yeah, do another one. Oh, it's so funny. You know, they just enjoyed it. And it was a great time. I'm like, wow, this is okay. It's amazing. So, I've kind of loved it ever since. Now, you went through a bit of a transition. I want to talk about this first because you were serving in the Royal Navy. And I now did, you're yes. in the consumer products industry.
Yes.
Tell us how that happened.
So I was one of the, I was a bit of a rebel, if I can call myself that, when I was younger. My grandfather was in the Navy. My dad obviously was running around the world on oil platforms and engineering and building ships, etc. And the northern English village where I was from, which I loved dearly, but that wasn't really at the time where I wanted to be. I wanted to travel. And what better way to do that than join the Navy? So I joined at 16. In fact, I was 16 and 2 months. And I got on a train from Carlisle Station in Cumbria. I went to Plymouth. They shaved my head within, which still shaved now. They shaved my head within an hour of being there. I signed up for 22 years and basic training. And after basic training, went into the submarine school and I was at sea before I was 18 because I remember my 18th birthday at sea in my bunk. That nobody recognized, by the way. Not one person said, happy birthday. I had my 18th birthday opening my cards in my bunk and seeing who'd sent me cards. And then I did 4 years on one nuke boat. And then I did some training boats, which were diesel. And then I left. And strangely, I left with what you would call I had a naval education, which wasn't quite a degree at the time, but I sort of sold it as a degree, and I got a job in retail management with a national electrical firm in the UK. I could have been anything. It could have been anything. It could have been in groceries, TVs, sport, whatever. But I wanted to run my own shop. I had this thought of running my own high street shop. And within, as a graduate, called a graduate trainee, very quickly, I had a shop back in the north of England, not too far from where I was born. And that whole transition happened over about an 8 or 9 year period. So mid-20s, joined at 16, mid-20s was selling TVs and washing machines to local residents in a small town.
That's a very unique story. And that must have been quite the experience, especially being on a nuke boat. That must come with its own kind of emotion, or you just put it out of mind.
Oh, I sort of do know, and I've come to terms with it now, that on leaving the forces, I think everybody had some form of PTSD. It wasn't really thought about back in the, it's not going back a long time, but long enough that there was no counseling when you left. You just left the boat, the service, and that was it. You joined the reserves. If you went along, good. If you didn't, you didn't. I realize now I had a form of PTSD, which took me a long time to accept. And then I got older. I had kids, got married, and things sort of they calm down a little bit. I used to dream a lot of being back at sea, and the dreams were always the same. I would wake up and I'd be back on board, and I would say to myself, oh my goodness, I've rejoined again, I'm back at sea. And then I would wake up and go, oh, it's a dream. And it used to recur over and over and over again. And I think now when I look at it, probably fear, you know, going on a boat, diving for the first time, a boat that, you know, like all navies and military around the world is, it goes to sea barely serviceable sometimes. It's just serviceable to go to sea. It just works. And then a lot of repairing and fixing is done when you're at sea. You know, and that when I look back now, and especially when I'm told by people, do you know that piece of equipment? Yes. Do you know it never worked? And you go, really? No, never. We tried to fix it a lot, but it never got to work. And you sort of go, oh, wow.
Well, it brought you probably a lot of resiliency. And then you had the entrepreneurial spirit, clearly, going on to electronics and starting your own shop or running your own shop. So it's served you well. And like you said, as you get married and you have kids and life just gets bigger, it makes being able to put to bed, so to speak, those types of things a little bit easier too. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of those iconic brands that you've worked with, like Hunter, Swims, Uggs, Mizuno. All brands that most everybody who hasn't been living under a rock should know. Can you discuss maybe key strategies that you've used to implement these brands' success in the APAC region?
So if you look at the brands, there's two that stand out that I've been very fortunate. And I say this a lot to people when I say that I've been in two brands that scaled very quickly. They went from zero to hero. Almost an overnight success, but UGG wasn't an overnight success. UGG had been sold to Deckers as basically a winter option. So if you think about it, Deckers owns a brand called Teva. Teva is a summer brand, and effectively they wanted a winter brand to sort of cover off the cash flow during the winter.
That's the summer sandals with the Velcro straps and stuff, the Tevas.
Yeah. That's a great story on its own, how that started and the person who started it and how they made a massive amount of money out of a D-ring. That's what they patented. The D-ring on the Teva sandal is the ring that connects the strap at the back, the strap down the lateral side, and the strap across the front. That was what was patented, and that's what was sold at the end of the day. And that was a ring. That was just a D-ring. That's it. Mark Thatcher, the guy that he actually created that. That's worthy an episode on its own, just where you know, follow the money. But in terms of UGG, it's sort of at the time, the marketing manager in Deckers had no money to market the product, so I ended up taking stock. Said to her boss, "Listen, I'll take stock. I'll take 1,000 pairs and I'll give them away," which was unique at the time. You know, that seeding product, pre-social media, etc. And to me, the iconic shot, the one that always stuck in my mind, was Pamela Anderson as she was papped at the time. Wearing a pair of sloppy Joes, getting inside an Escalade. She had a baby in one arm, Starbucks in another, Uggs on, a great tousled blonde hair, dark glasses. And it was that sort of iconic shot of, here is a woman doing it her way. Everything she wants, everything that was just Californian, her self-expression, everything about it. And what I didn't realize at the time was that sort of created a whole stock of young women who were 13 at the time, looked at this image, said, I want to be like that, but they couldn't afford the sort of any of the products. And then by the time they got to 16, 17, they were going out to buy that classic UGG look. And we all got to see that type of image, even sort of cartoon version of that image with the Uggs on, the big hair, the big eyes, that sort of, you know, female archetype at that time. And then I realized that what we were selling was culture. We weren't selling a boot at that time. We're actually selling a look. And that look was then very easy to sell. So going to the likes of a GDS in Germany to present the brand, people were coming in with pictures of people wearing them saying, we want this product. Is this the real product that we can buy? The effect was amazing. You know, it went from zero from sort of, I think Holland was selling about 8,000 pairs at the time, and we managed Europe. We, as the agency I was in at the time. And 8,000 pairs isn't a lot, but Holland's an early adopter market. And then the UK went from zero to sort of 50,000 pieces in 6 months as a buy. And then that sell-through was almost immediate. So if you look at the Asian markets, Japan picked it up very, very quickly. Korea picked it up. Southeast Asia picked it up, and it went from nothing. And the challenge was at that time, of course, not only the selling was sort of easy, it was then making them, keeping the production going, because production spiked massive.
Would you call this the tussled blonde hair strategy?
The strategy for me, that what I recognized at the time is that something was happening in the press around a particular look. And when I then went to Hunter, so firstly, I tried to buy the Hunter boot brand. I probably could have afforded to buy it because it was in administration. It really wasn't that much to buy. So I could have raised the money. I could have, you know, I could have put the house up. I could have gone to some friends and said, listen, I've already got experience in this. We can flip this in a few years' time. What I realize now is that I'd have lost all my money on the first production run. I could have afforded the company, and then I could never have afforded the production. That would have been it. I'd have been out. But at that time, UGG was doing something very similar to Hunter. Firstly, it was a boot. Secondly, it was very visual on the masthead of a paper. You could see it. But therein lies its beauty. Kate Moss started wearing them at Glastonbury. And I thought, wow, that's a similar sort of look to Pamela Anderson. It's gone forward 10 years, but it's a similar, it's a female, she's powerful, she's wearing these boots, she's in a situation which the youth are going to like. And I sort of jumped on it straight away. I thought that has to do exactly the same as UGG. And it did. It scaled massively, very quickly. Sadly, it's not lasted, by the way. It didn't make it through COVID. And it never really created the foundations of the brand that UGG Australia did. But it scaled massively. And here's the thing at the time, which I found fascinating, is you could almost time the rise of Hunter to the death of the music industry in the form of buying CDs, because people were moving on to MP3 style, listening to music, iPods, etc. And of course, the artists weren't making any money, so they had to switch strategy to go to big shows. So Glastonbury went from a sort of a relatively local, almost folk-type festival to this huge, big international event. Muddy Fields, you need a particular type of item to get there. You go into your parents' shed, you pick out their old Hunter boots, and off you go to the festival looking exactly the same as Kate Moss. So in truth, I've got to thank the music industry for creating the vacuum of which Hunter happened to fill. And that was filled by tens of thousands of pairs and selling both music one side and the Queen the other side, which was that sort of royal family British cultural link back to rural estate farming with people wearing tweed and green boots.
So was that running or maybe piggybacking off a look or a picture or a person really the only strategy necessary to bring about success in the APAC markets?
Certainly from a Japan perspective, yes, because Japan obviously as a culture loves everything that is English. So the Japanese distributor at the time, it actually flipped to a different distributor, but the Japanese distributor at the time was buying everything that was English, culturally English. So he drove a Range Rover, he had a Fox umbrella, which is a very expensive umbrella. It was anglicized. He loved everything that was English. So he got the boot straight away in terms of selling that Britishness. But in terms of, is that what turned the whole APAC market? Well, sort of in a way, yes, because those images, especially the Kate Moss image, and you may recall it, she was wearing a tweed style waistcoat. She's wearing a short skirt. She had black hunter boots on. She was mud up, you know, the mud was halfway up. She had that very Englishy look, but also sort of doing it her way. She was, you know, there she was in this Glastonbury concert style backstage. Going back to the sort of Oasis type days where a lot of young women and men for that, like they would carry around bottles of Jack Daniels as a sort of we're drinking it from the neck of a JD bottle, and you'd have that very square, iconic bottle. And it sort of give that very, very iconic music, English, Tony Blair type look. And that just have accelerated the Britishness and the brand itself. So it was never a case of selling it. It was a case of finding out the distributors with the best ability to scale as quick as possible, and then making sure that production could keep up, which was always a challenge.
Mike, I wanted to ask if you might be able to just tell us a little bit about your own proprietary brand.
I actually have two. One is in hibernation, which is a sandal called, aptly named, Tudeck, which is after the company I set up here. And Tudeck is the second deck of a submarine. That's why I called it Tudeck, because I was on Tudeck my whole junior career, and I cleaned Tudeck, so I scrubbed Tudeck every night. And asking other sailors to pick their feet up as I scrubbed underneath them, and then they put their feet down. So it was never about cleaning. It was about control. But the other brand that was started, it sort of started 4 years ago, but actually the brand was going a long time before that. It was a brand, or is a brand, called Free World Australia. And Free World Australia, it started out as a surf brand by my co-founder, Imran Omar, who's actually, the office is based in Brisbane. And he had this sort of very strange surf brand, wasn't working particularly well. And then he sort of, because of what I was doing, and he was following me in terms of recovery sandals, he sort of created a recovery sandal on his own, brought me in as a consultant and said, listen, what do you think of this sandal? And I looked at it and thought, well, it's not the design I would have used. And I think some of the material you're using is not particularly great. And that sort of got us formed into a relationship. I then joined on a sweat equity deal sort of before COVID, not that COVID was the trigger to do it, but it was before COVID. I thought it was a great idea to do recovery sandals. And then COVID hit and the brand changed sort of overnight. It went from recovery sandals to walking. And it went to walking because, of course, during COVID, all we did was walk. And I walked the bay, which is a bay around, it's around the inner west of Sydney. So it's a Canada Bay, will take you around. It's a big loop. It's about an 8K loop. And I would sometimes do it once, maybe twice a day. I could do 16K and it would give me an ability to just relax, get my mind flowing, get ready to come back and handle the kids who were obviously homeschooled at that time. And born was the Free World Australia that we've got now, which is a podiatry approved walking shoe brand. That's a long way from the Free World Australia surf band, but being Free World Australia, it's sort of got the free movement, free ability to walk, and all around that sort of Australian vibe, cities, urban walking, not running, not trekking. It's sort of that urban coffee, read a book, chill out, walking brand.
Let's talk a little bit about Deeren & Associates. Hmm. You're a senior advisor there. Talk to us about your role and how you're helping consumer product companies scale internationally.
So interestingly, I was tracking Cynthia Deeren, who is the principal of Deeren & Associates, because Tudeck and Deeren sort of sit within the same wheelhouse. I tended to help brands that were on the sort of fashion, footwear, clothing, accessories, watches, anything that I sort of was comfortable sitting within and had done for a long time. I used to get her blogs and I read them and I thought, we do very similar things, but her product, she would do a lot different, a lot wider product than me. And she would run forums, and the forums were getting sort of local businesses in Australia into a room to talk about their international experience, what they were doing, their problems, their challenges, etc. And I rang up and said, can I come along? And one of the ladies out of the business rang me and started taking my details. And I said, listen, I've just got to tell you, I do the sort of same thing that you do. So I'm going to come in. I'm not going to say I'm going to steal all your IP because I'm not, but I am going to listen to your IP and some of it's going to stick. And I do the same thing. And they went, oh, it's okay. Come along. You'll add value. And I went along, and this is about 2 years ago, and I watched some of the IP that she developed and of which I now use. And I just thought it was fantastic how she took a brand and started to reflect back at it what it was to go into the international market. What do you know? What do you not know? And within that, I found my sort of, if I can call it my spiritual home, I sort of found an ability to say, you're selling international in a way that I've always wanted to. And that then led me to join her company as an advisor. And now I get to work across lots of different things. So at the moment, I'm working on everything from first aid kits, which are an incredible first aid kit, an intuitive first aid kit, to menstrual underwear, which again is a phenomenally huge opportunity, big market, great company here that sort of, you could almost call it in the tech space in how they've managed to sort of create their the garment layering within the underwear. And then on the other side, I've just picked up a client in hospital grade sinks that are made here out of an alloy, beautifully welded together. And we've just booked a trade show in Kentucky for next April. So we'll be taking this Gold Coast based engineering brand that does phenomenally good theater equipment, and we'll be taking it to a trade show in Kentucky, and Deering is helping it get there, and we will do all the distributor finding, and hopefully we'll bring on board some partners in the US. So I do a lot of things. On one side it's soft goods, the other side it can be hard goods, but they all follow the same sort of principles of how to take a product from this island, this continent that's a long, long way away, how do we get it into these international markets that are at the other side of the world and everything that entails that?
I guess that's what I'm actually interested in, is advice to the audience or some understanding to the audience of how you actually help consumer product companies scale internationally.
I have some things that I have, some sort of go-to things that I do for brands when I meet them for the first time. And especially Australian brands, is the first thing I ask them for is their pricer. Can I see where your prices are? What are you selling at? Where's your margins? Because invariably, Aussie brands, and I can say that, they don't think international first, so they think domestic. So their margins tend to be for a domestic audience. And when they do come to us, or they go on their own and they venture international, they realize that they've not actually planned any margins for a international audience. So there's no distributor margin there. So I go to that first. If I find the margins don't work, I've got to give them the really bad news that they've only got two things to do. Firstly, they've got to either raise prices or they've got to go back and get cheaper production or create a whole new line, which is purely for the international audience. That's it. So I do pricing first. I like pricing because pricing is the sort of first thing that you and the entrepreneur or the company can eyeball each other and say, we need to work on this. So pricing is one of the things I do very, very quickly. And then I start to break down every department. Have you got... Do you have somebody in the company that you're going to have as your international sales director, international VP, international sales manager? And invariably, certainly from an Aussie brand point of view, they don't have one, because these roles tend to sit across every department. So international needs to know product, it needs to know finance, it needs to know marketing, it needs to know logistics. It tends to be a generalist across a whole swathe of departments within a company. So I then go in and start to advise, A, how the structure of that desk, if I can call it a desk, is set up. And then I help them put it together. So when invariably we leave, when the work is done, that desk is active. So they have an ability to bring somebody in to run that desk straight away. And I'm very passionate about that because I would like that company not to lose any of the momentum that I bring to it and have somebody that comes in and immediately picks up where I've left off. Because international is it never stops. It's a constantly growing, evolving part of the business. And, you know, if I can finish off with this, in Australia, international, if it's programmed right, if it's launched right, within 3 to 5 years could be the bigger part of the business. So you might have a company with only 25% of product at home, 75% of the product is overseas. So you immediately become a sort of a schizophrenic, counter-cyclical beast that has got to be run from Europe, but with its soul still in Australia. Which is why I think a lot of Aussie companies end up, you know, the really good ones are bought, because they're brought more into the sort of Europe or US. And they can only scale so much here because we're a country of only 25 million people. That's it. So... Yep. Once you've reached the limit here, what do you do?
Sister country to Canada, really, in yes. many, many ways. Now, being an APAC Sherpa for as many brands and companies as you have been, I'm sure that you have now probably a pretty good idea of where not to go, the pitfalls that lay upon the journey. Can you talk to our audience about where some of those pitfalls might be and how to best avoid them?
If I could talk to it from a country specific point of view. So, yeah. So brands that come in, certainly brands that come in from Europe or America, that want to come into the APAC region, certainly they look at Australia and think it's the biggest market in the world. It's almost like paved with gold. We want to be in Australia. We'd love to be represented here. Can you help us in Australia? And I'll say, of course we can. But I have to say to you first off that this is a tiny market. So don't expect massive scale here. It's also risk averse. We're not early adopters in Australia. So, you know, we wait for it to happen somewhere else before it happens here. So we tend to get products that they're not absolutely, if I can call it, you know, the biggest trend straight away. We tend to wait for a season or two seasons before it comes here. We're also expensive, so margins here are expected to be large in terms of a distributor margin, because a lot of times they've got to, certainly if it's in fashion, soft goods, etc., you've got to hold that product until the marketing either catches up or you use somebody else's marketing from overseas. So our summers, I mean, the summer, the weather you're seeing outside now is my spring sun. So we're coming into summer as everybody else is going into winter. So if you're delivering winter products into Europe, you're also shipping winter products into Australia. So Australia either picks colors which it can launch and fabrics which are light enough, or it holds on to the product and it launches it next year. So it's got to cash flow that product for a whole year. It's got to store it. Doesn't get any money released. So that's a challenge for anybody coming here because they think it's going to be huge and it's not. But what you do get is beautiful weather, great imagery, great backdrop, and you can do a photo shoot here, which gives you huge global appeal because you bring the bridge in, the Opera House, the Outback, the sun, Bondi Beach, etc. And then if you switch that to a Japan, Japan's a unique market because it is it's a slow burn, so it likes to go start small. But it also is very interested in licensing. So make sure your trademarks are absolutely bolted down in Japan, because Japan will sit on your trademark and take it as theirs if you've not got a Japanese trademark. And also very often they will license. So I remember being at a meeting many years ago when I looked at a table in a distributor and they were doing Paul Smith, small leather goods for Paul Smith. And I looked at them and went, wow, these are crazy, crazy designs. I said, I can't quite understand it. It's not particularly London, but what is it? And it ended up being a license that Paul Smith had given this Japanese distributor. And they'd sort of twisted Paul Smith. They'd made it a Japanese version of that London designer. And they do that for their own home audience. So they'll buy some of the collection, but they'll also license a portion of it for their own home market. And then you've got markets like Singapore, extremely small, but again, does a lot of consignment. So when you talk about consignment on the shop floor, that's difficult for a brand to understand, where the distributors put products on a shop floor and wait for it to sell before they get their money. So buying forward is difficult. And then, of course, you know, the monolith that is China, which is multiple markets in one country, with all of the challenges that has, and those evolving challenges over the years of how, you know, figuring out retail in China, where do you go? What retail channels do you go into? Figuring out social media. And of course, you know, in a lot of ways, what brought me to WPIC was seeing this real opportunity to launch the brand without bricks and mortar in China, to actually get a scale quite quickly, to control all of that social content in one company. To me, it was like, wow, where was this 10 years ago when people were saying to me, we're going to set you up on a selling platform? Well, who does it? I need to go back and tell the company what you're doing. I need to figure this out. How is it working? Where's the software? Whereas WPIC just said, we do this. And that's one of the things that brought me to them. But I could go on. Korea. You know, if you want to go to Korea, make sure that you've got a good liver, because the Korean market does like a drink, and you tend to do a lot of socializing, a lot of soju, a lot of soju dipped into beer, sort of turbocharging that beer. That's a challenge.
Better than the soju is better than the baijiu.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I once asked a colleague. I also asked some colleagues why they were drinking so fast. It's like 6 o'clock. And I said, guys, slow down. And they looked at me as if to say, but we're here to get drunk. But it's the whole object is getting drunk quickly. And I realized at the time that was Korea. That was get in, get tanked very quick. And, yeah. You know, I'm old enough to have done that 25 years ago in my early part of my international career. And now as I've matured, I don't do that anymore. Not that I don't want to. It still sounds very exciting, but the pain is now too much. It's those days have gone. Those days.
The 7-8 days to recover now is just not worth it.
Well, that sounds like a man who knows what a 7 to 8 day recovery cycle feels like. It's 7 to 8 days. It's it's the going into the black dog depression and then clawing your way back out of it, and especially if you add jet lag onto that, it's not good.
No, it's not at all. Let's talk about Australian brands.
Yes.
Looking to expand abroad. What kind of advice, or let's actually curve that. Let's talk about sectors. What sectors do you think currently hold the most promising growth opportunities for Australian brands looking to expand abroad?
I think one of the most exciting sectors here in Australia is food and beverage, because we do have the most beautiful raw material in terms of food. So I think in my suburb alone, which is the inner west of Sydney, I think there's certainly over 30 craft beer breweries in the inner west. I don't know if you've walked past craft breweries before. We get that lovely hoppy smell as you think, oh, that carob, where's that? That beautiful smells in the air. So craft beers, and some of them are phenomenal. You know, what the beer itself is a beer drinker. You know, it's a nice taste, etc. But it sort of captures everything that is Australia: the artwork, the naming of the beer, where it's from, whether it be Young Henry's is a beer near me, and it does New Towner Ale, and New Towner is the sort of eclectic little town not far from here. So you're selling not only the beer, but you're selling a culture. So food and beverage. Food we get here, I think, is tremendously good. And I look at this food and say, this should be in the international market. Why aren't you at a trade show in London? Why aren't you at a beautiful craft fair at Chelsea Flower Show, where you're showing this incredibly good fare and getting it onto the shelves of your Waitrose, Tesco's, Marks and Spencer's, etc.
But there's a physical distance barrier just on the food and beverage, because a lot of it, you know, it's perishable. And
yes,
geographically, there's a little bit of an extra hiccup involved.
Yes, yeah, no, of course, and we've done some work recently on a banana bread company. Now, banana bread is very—I mean, I didn't really know banana bread until I came to Australia. So it's one of those things that I'd never really heard of. So so I came to Australia, and then to get that
your grandmother
toast,
failed you.
She, north of England, yeah, I got a lot of toast. But I never got banana bread. I got a lot of sponge cake. A lot of Victoria sponge cake with a lot of icing, but never banana bread.
So you were okay then? You were doing just fine.
I was okay. My teeth are testament to my north of England. I often think that, you know, sugar intake. People say sugar intake is really bad these days. You know, people should eat less sugar. And I say, you want to see real sugar? You want to see what real lemonade does to your teeth? Mm. I've had a lot of fillings over the years. All the sort of lead amalgam has been taken out with some lovely white fillings, but they're still teeth from a certain age. No, but banana bread. So banana bread companies, there's quite a few of them here. We one particular one, which we did some work for, and that was sending over frozen. And you can keep it frozen for 18 months, and then you can defrost it, and then it's got to sell by, you know, a typical sort of post-defrosting. So you are correct. You know, the logistics on shipping now is very important for Australian companies, as is the opportunity for local manufacturing, local license agreements that you may wish to enter into. So Aussie brands will do one of two things. You know, A, you've got to get the product there, but also you can partner with other bigger manufacturers and have a licensing deal that sort of somehow. And if you think of the likes of Cadbury's is a factory's. I mean, Cadbury's has a big factory in New Zealand, and I remember tasting Cadbury's for the first time. My wife's a Kiwi, and interestingly, she thought Cadbury's was a New Zealand company. It's a Middle England chocolate company. But when you taste a Cadbury's milk chocolate, it tastes completely different. The UK version is sweet and creamy. The New Zealand version isn't as sweet, but it's the same. It's the same packaging. That's effectively a manufacturing license deal. They weren't going to ship chocolate from the other side of the world, but they shipped a cultural icon, and now it's made to specific tastes for the APAC market.
Mike Todd, Senior Advisor, Consumer Products with Deeren & Associates. Thank you for coming on the show today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
All right. For everybody who are watching us on YouTube, don't forget we have the audio version over on all your favorite podcast platforms. And if you're listening to us audio only, don't forget that we have the live video as well, plus a bunch of YouTube shorts as well over on the WPIC YouTube channel. But for me and for Mike and for everybody at The Negotiation, thank you very much for listening and or watching. And we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.